The following program contains scenes and language of a frank and explicit nature. Viewer discretion is advised.
Are you incapable of restraining yourself, or do you take pride in being an insufferable know-it-all?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Film Jitsu, the podcast that wields film like deadly weapons. We are your host. I am John.
And I am Mike.
And this week, Mike will be reviewing the Kevin Costner-Whitney Houston bomb, that is The Bodyguard. This is a 1992 film with, as I said, Whitney Houston. This is in her pre-drug-induced slide into obscurity. And it's actually the sort of sweet spot in Kevin Costner's career. It's around the time that he did Field of Dreams, Robin Hood, JFK. So he was sort of in a lot of stuff. I guess sweet spot is sort of relative when it comes to Kevin Costner. Interestingly enough, this movie was originally written. It was written by Louis Kasdan, who has been involved in screenplays of Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, Raiders of the Lost Ark. He originally wrote this in the 70s for Steve McQueen, and then it was dug back up in 1992. The movie is obviously known for the music. Whitney Houston involved. Obviously, it was going to be known for the music. The big song being the I Will Always Love You, her version of the 1974 Dolly Parton hit. It was that, actually, because the category at the Oscars is Best Original Song, that song was not nominated, but two songs from this soundtrack were nominated for Oscars, I Have Nothing and Run to You. It did not win, but did get the nod for two of the songs from the soundtrack. It was also nominated for 6 Razzies, as we often point out, the Golden Raspberries for Worst Achievements in Movies. It was nominated for 6, but lost them all. So why don't we go ahead and roll the trailer?
This is my disguise.
Well, his timing's good.
Henry, I've spent a lot of time guarding people all over the world, and I found one thing to be true. No matter how incompetent the assassins, no matter how much they miss their target, there's one person who always gets hit. Who? The cocky black chauffeur.
You afraid I might get picked off for my snazzy running suit?
No, I'm afraid that I'm going to have to jog with you. I won't hold it back
again. Someone was in my house? Wait a minute, someone was in my house?
Everybody's afraid of something. That's how we know we care about things. When we're afraid we'll lose it.
You, Frank Farmer, out there on the edge.
Rachel, I don't want to get confused about what I'm doing here.
I want to confuse.
You pay me to protect you. That's what I do.
And what is it?
I'm afraid of not being there.
All right, Mike. So, what'd you think of this one?
Well, I gotta tell you, I went into The Bodyguard feeling quite pessimistic. I can't say that the prospect of Whitney Houston acting was in any way appealing. And Kevin Costner can be so good or so terrible. And I wasn't really sure what I was going to get here, because, like you mentioned, sort of the sweet spot in his career. And actually, I think that's valid, because there's a run, basically, where he did The Untouchables in 87 and Bull Durham in 88, and then Dances with Wolves in 1990, Robin Hood, which I wouldn't call sweet, in 91, and JFK right before The Bodyguard. So he had some really good stuff leading up to The Bodyguard. So I thought, maybe this will be on point. But shortly thereafter in his career, just a few years down the line, was Waterworld and Tin Cup and The Postman. So I thought, oh, Jesus. I have to say that at the end of the day, The Bodyguard was much better than I was expecting.
Wow.
I don't know if that's surprising to people to hear me say that I didn't hate The Bodyguard. It's surprising to me. It's kind of a little embarrassing to say that I didn't hate The Bodyguard. But I think that when Kevin Costner, he's at his best when he plays a man obsessed. And in this movie, he certainly plays a man obsessed with his work. I think some of the best work that he's done is JFK and The Untouchables, where in JFK he is absolutely obsessed with uncovering the assassination of Kennedy, and The Untouchables, where he is absolutely obsessed with bringing down Al Capone. Here, he's obsessed with his work and protecting Whitney Houston's character, Rachel Marin, who is basically Whitney Houston. I think Whitney Houston actually was very effective in this role because she kind of had to play a bitch.
Yeah.
And I think if we know anything about current-day drugged-out Whitney Houston, she kind of is. This is Whitney Houston playing Whitney Houston, so it's not really much of a stretch for her. And I don't really think it's a stretch for Kevin Costner, because, like I said, he's just doing his man-obsessed thing. But it really is a tight thriller. It was well-directed, well-paced. The characters were, I think, fairly well-rounded, if not always acted superbly. I think you get to see a lot of different sides of these particular actors. I do think that it has moments that I think are exceptionally good. There is a scene early on when Kevin Costner is taking over as her head of security, and it's almost a montage of him setting up all the different security around her mansion. I am a sucker for setting things up in movies. I like it when they build stuff. You know what? There is a kids' movie called Camp Nowhere, where the kids set up their fake summer camp to look like a number of different summer camps, like theater camp and fat camp and military camp. It's a ridiculously goofy montage. I love it. This was like a really serious version of that. And there is a scene when Whitney Houston is singing at a club and the crowd gets out of control and it's very tense, because always lurking in this movie, always present, is this crazy person that wants to assassinate Whitney Houston. And it really does a good job of establishing that tension that you feel as an audience member. You're almost always looking over your shoulder. But, man, there are moments. They're the Whitney Houston music video moments that I could absolutely do without. Because while this might be a tight thriller, it was also a vehicle for launching an awful lot of Whitney Houston tunes.
Yep.
And, man, I could do without them. They show music videos of her. They show her, you know, there are performance sequences, that kind of thing. It is more time than I ever want to listen to Whitney Houston ever. One thing I will say, definitely in its favor, is the score was done by Alan Silvestri, and it was good. You know, not the Whitney Houston music, but the actual score for the movie. It was moody and melancholy and romantic, all sort of at the same time. And Alan Silvestri is no slouch. Dude's composed music for Forrest Gump and The Abyss and Back to the Future and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. He's done a lot of good stuff, and I don't think this is any exception. And that's not a surprise, because the guy went to the Berklee College of Music in Boston, so dude's got some New England chops. But I guess overall, I can't really complain. I think it was, for what it set out to accomplish, I think it accomplished it fairly well.
So you weren't driven over the edge by Whitney?
You know, I really wasn't. I think that she wasn't asked to do a whole lot. I think both Whitney Houston and Kevin Costner were nominated for Razzies for their performances back in 92. And I guess I just don't really see why. She wasn't particularly good, but she wasn't really particularly awful either. She was playing, in a lot of ways, herself. I mean, her character was a famous singer. Well, that doesn't really seem like much of a stretch. If there were a movie where Kevin Costner were to protect a fat loudmouth, and they asked me to play the fat loudmouth, I think I could probably do that okay. I think I could probably nail that one. And so, you know, Whitney Houston does an acceptable job of playing herself.
Yep.
Kevin Costner, like I said, he's a man possessed, and I think that works for him in this film. So, no, it didn't really drive me over the edge.
My favorite part of that is Kevin Costner lost the Worst Actor Razzie to Sylvester Stallone in Stop, Oh, My Mom Will Shoot.
Oh, snap. Really?
Yep.
Well, that seems fair. That really does seem quite fair.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I know this is a sort of unprecedented for Film Jitsu, where I was expecting to hate the movie. I thought I was really going to have to rip into it. And, you know, I think this fits nicely in with a lot of those 90s thrillers along the same vein as In the Line of Fire and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
It really was not a terrible film. One thing I can say, though, is that there was a scene in the film that was terribly disappointing, because it's a confession scene, actually. And it should have been a big scene in the movie. It's a confession scene. So somebody should be spilling their guts about, you know, what's going on, and it should be an important moment in the movie. And the actor or actress in this scene is awful. Like, really, really community theater bad. And I thought, oh, God, like, I couldn't believe that this made it into the film. You know, when you're dealing with Whitney Houston and you have to kind of wrangle in a non-actress and make her act, and you manage to do that more often than not, and you're dealing with Kevin Costner, who can be pretty bland. When you have a scene with a big confession, you know, a big heartfelt crying, pouring out your guts moment, that scene really better deliver, and it does not. So I was really disappointed. It's a moment where you should have really had a payoff here, and it did not work due to what was a really terrible couple minutes of acting on screen, which was too bad.
Well, the director, as I said, is not a powerhouse director by any stretch, so...
No, I guess not. But, you know, it's funny, because as I was looking up what was going on with director Mick Jackson... This movie did really well at the time. I mean, it was a thing. And surprisingly, after this, he wasn't offered really anything. The movie he did immediately after The Bodyguard was a couple years later. It was Clean Slate with Dana Carvey. It's a goofy amnesia comedy. And it seemed somehow unfair to the director. He had done something... I think that, you know, at least earned some money.
Yeah.
Definitely got the film noticed because of some excellent songs in it. And he got to follow it up with Clean Slate and then shortly after Volcano.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It was unfortunate, I guess, the way things turned out for him. But after seeing that one scene and how really ghastly this particular performance is, I thought, well, maybe that's fair then. Maybe he deserves it. You teased, I think, in our last episode, the scarf scene.
Yep.
You really had me kind of nervous about the scarf scene. You made it sound like it was going to be the worst thing anybody had ever seen. And it kind of was. I mean, it was just so tacky. And the movie starts with them, of course, a lot of movies. I think the setup was destined for these two characters to get off on the wrong foot. It just seems sort of a requirement of the story. Over time, they build an affection for each other, and one night they decide to mix business with pleasure with katana blades, basically. And they go back to Kevin Costner's cruddy little apartment, and she discovers he has a sword there, and she starts playing with it. There's an awful lot of phallic imagery. And then he takes a scarf seductively from round her neck and tosses it up into the air, and it floats back down and slices in half right over the blade of the sword. And I guess that's all the lady needed to decide it was time to put out for the bodyguard. It was really cheesy.
Yeah.
It was a really cheesy scene.
I'm pretty sure,
but I don't know,
if you try to set that scene up as a way of getting down with any lady... and you slice her silk scarf in half with a sword, you're not getting booty out of that situation. You're probably
getting... do you know one woman in the world where you can cut her clothes in half and she's like, well, that's it, now I'm putting out. Nope. And I gotta tell you, I cannot think of a lot of times, and maybe I'm just a little more vanilla than I thought, but I cannot think of very many times in my life where sex and swords are involved. Usually, if there's a sword in the room, you think maybe it's time to be responsible and put away the dangerous weapon before anybody takes their pants off.
Yes. Generally.
I don't know about you, but I don't ever want to have my pants down around a katana.
No, absolutely not. It's interesting. It was almost a very different movie, because the role was originally offered to someone other than Whitney Houston. It was actually originally offered to Madonna.
Yeah.
Madonna does not have the pipes to pull off that I Will Always Love You song. Sorry.
No, she does not. No. You know, I gotta tell you, this music, I remember all of these songs really well, because my mom really likes Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
And during the time when this came out, we used to make frequent trips to the Boston area in the family Aerostar. And my mom would play these Whitney Houston songs and sing along. And they were sort of painful at the time because it was embarrassing to have your mom belting out Whitney Houston. But they're a fond childhood memory now, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this soundtrack was a big deal, for sure.
It was a very big deal. I mean, you mentioned earlier, I think you called the Bodyguard a bomb. It really wasn't. I mean, this was a movie that was popular. It did well, and the album that came about as a result of it did really well.
Yeah, no, that was personal opinion.
Well, fair enough. You're entitled, I guess. I guess that's it. I would actually recommend, I think for the first time in one of my Film Jitsu reviews, check out The Bodyguard. It's actually not nearly as bad as it should have been.
Yeah. All right, so I guess that's probably, yeah, it's a Film Jitsu. Well, it might not be a first. I know we did say go check out Lost Boys, The Tribe.
Okay,
so we did,
well, sure,
we did
fair.
Think that was fun. So, but this might be the first one that, as a full-on review, one of us is assigned to the other, that we say, you know what, go and check out.
Yeah, I think it's the first one where I can say this is actually probably a pretty good film overall. I was surprised. I really was. I thought this was a recipe for hatred. I was not prepared to actually enjoy the film, and I think that I did.
Well,
so I guess the joke's on you there, buddy.
Apparently, I did try to set up for a whole bunch of hate there, I think. I mean, the last time I saw it was probably in 92 or 93, so...
When you were 42?
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, at that age, I definitely wasn't feeling a Whitney Houston, Kevin Costner thriller.
No, that's true. I mean, my mom really liked it, and usually when you're a kid and your mom really likes something, that's a sign that it's trouble.
Exactly.
I'm sure we have listeners right now really rolling our eyes at the fact that I'm talking about being a kid in 92. So I'm sorry if I'm making anybody feel like I'm some young punk who doesn't know what I'm talking about, because, well, truth is, I probably am.
Why don't we go ahead and get into our bottom five then, since we've been talking a bit about the music. We went ahead on this episode and decided that our bottom five would be bottom five signature movie songs.
Yes.
So why don't you start it off there, Mike? What was your number five bottom movie, signature movie song?
My number five is Ghostbusters Rap. From 1989's Ghostbusters 2, done by Run DMC. It was a shameful treatment of the original Ray Parker Jr. theme.
Yep.
Full of dopey rhymes. Like, just dopey. Rhyming, you know, spine with fine and chill with thrill and dumb, dumb stuff. As a matter of fact, allow me, if you will, an excerpt here. I remember the time I visited the grave... My life on the line, only my life to save. All by myself, with no one around, did not understand a hand coming out of the ground.
Oh.
I knew it wasn't mine, it was somebody else, but I didn't care, gee, I just screamed for help. That's not even a ghost!
No.
That's a zombie. A hand coming out of the ground, that's a zombie. They're not zombie busters. It was weak.
Yep.
It was ridiculously weak, because everybody loves... that Ghostbusters theme song from Ray Parker Jr. And to hear some stupid Run DMC rap over it, unacceptable.
Yeah.
I just really remember the first time I saw Ghostbusters 2 groaning at the rap version of the Ghostbusters song. So that made my list because it spoiled something I love.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great movie and a great rap group and just not working. Well, my number five is similar, actually. It's from a band who has done some great stuff, but this is not one of them. I'm talking about the Aerosmith hit Don't Want to Miss a Thing from Armageddon.
Oh, man. Ugh. I really considered it for my list.
I can't handle the song. I really can't. It's late Aerosmith. It's late not good Aerosmith. And this song just puts me over the edge. It was written by Diane Warren, who's been nominated for original song a bunch of times, including for this one. And she actually said that the song was originally written for Celine Dion.
Oh, Jesus.
The only way I can imagine this song getting worse is if it's performed by Celine Dion instead of Aerosmith.
Yeah, I guess. Man, I thought about this song. So many people love this song. I can't stand it. It's the worst form of screechy Steven Tyler mm-hmm. that there is. If the only way you can think to express love to somebody is by having an over-the-hill dinosaur of a rock performer screech at them, you've done something wrong.
Yes.
It's just trite. It's so melodramatic. Mm-hmm. And I remember all the... It was a tearjerker song to go along with what was a shamelessly tearjerker moment in a shamelessly tearjerker movie.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't stand it. This is a song I do not like at all.
You know what's sad, though, is it's actually Aerosmith's most successful single.
It's true.
And that makes me cry inside a little.
It was huge. It was huge mm-hmm. when it came out.
The funny thing is it was nominated for Best Original Song at the Academy Awards. It was also nominated for Worst Song at the Razzies.
Well, I think that time the Razzies probably had it right. My number four, Mr. Carmichael, is... Come What May, from the 2001 musical Moulin Rouge.
Oh, yeah.
I tried really hard to leave musicals off of my list if they were stage plays first. Mm-hmm. So, although Oklahoma may be a ridiculously annoying song, it was meant for the stage, not really for movies. The song was sung by Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman, and it seems to me like any film with a reimagining of modern music... like The Police's Roxanne done as a tango, which I kind of dug mm-hmm. in Moulin Rouge. It's either something that's loved or hated, and it's the leg that Moulin Rouge stands on, is reimagining modern music. But the film is rife with painfully melodramatic duets between Kidman and Ewan McGregor, and Come What May is the worst of all of them. The accompanying visuals are great, but it sounds like a track from An American Tale, that movie with the little animated Russian mice. It's ridiculous. Sing out this song and I'll be there by your side. Storm clouds may gather and stars may collide.
But I love you.
The vocals are watery and off-key. Ewan McGregor couldn't carry a tune in a coffin, which is exactly where I wanted to be through the entire song. It's horrid. The movie's not bad in and of itself. The singing... Ewan McGregor, man, he's tone-deaf. He really is tone-deaf. But the film itself, from a visual perspective, from a creative perspective, isn't really awful. But... Come What May was just so melodramatic and... I'm getting sick just thinking about it.
Oh, man. All right, my number four is a movie that I know a lot of people have fond memories of, but this song has always irked me to no end. The Glory of Love by Peter Cetera from Karate Kid 2.
Jesus.
Yeah. Nominated again for Best Original Song, but lost to Take My Breath Away from Top Gun, another song that almost made my list. Also nominated for Golden Globe and a Grammy as well. I can't deal with it. The lyrics send me over the edge. It is cliche. It is your standard 80s love ballad with awful imagery and bad lyrics, and I just can't do it. It makes me insane.
I don't know that I can think of it off the top of my head. I am a man who will fight for your honor. I'll be the hero you're dreaming of. We'll live forever knowing together that we did it all for the glory of love.
Lyrics like, just like a knight in shining armor from a long time ago, just in time to save the day, take you to my castle far away.
Wow.
Yeah.
Unlike those knights, not from a long time ago, but from like last Thursday.
Yes.
That knight I met on the parkway, bought me a burrito. Well, maybe they'll include it in the remake of The Karate Kid, starring none other than Jackie Chan as Pat Morita.
Oh, man.
F+. Well, John, my number three is from a 1996 movie featuring animated animals and Michael Jordan.
Yes.
It's I Believe I Can Fly by R. Kelly.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
We share a number three.
All right. All right. Well, go ahead. You tell me why it's number three on your list.
I can't. It's actually the only one on my list not nominated for an Academy Award. Although it's been parodied and covered a bazillion times. Probably my favorite cover actually parody of it is Jim Carrey's parody of it in Fun with Dick and Jane. It's actually a pretty funny scene.
It's the only funny scene in Fun with Dick and Jane.
It really is. But
I hope I hope we don't have feedback next week where I have to explain why I hate that.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky. I think about it every night and day. Spread my wings and fly away. I believe I can soar. I see me running through that open door. I believe I can fly. I believe I can fly. I believe I can fly.
I mean, this song is the definition of that inspirational ballad. The lyrics all about believing in yourself and you can do anything and all that other crap we tell our kids, and I hate it. It sends me over the edge.
Can I tell you why I hate
yes.
it? All I can think of when I hear I Believe I Can Fly is my mom playing this song at top volume whenever she got really pissed off at my dad. It's like some terrifying First Wives Club flashback. It's got all the bombastic awfulness of typical R. Kelly without any of the borderline criminal lyrics from such timeless R. Kelly classics as Bangin' the Headboard, Kiss Your Candy, Half on a Baby, which I don't even want to know what that means, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention Feelin' on Yo Booty. I Believe I Can Fly is a prime example of the worst that 90s R&B had to offer. And dude, I don't want to hear a message of inspiration from a guy who got arrested for relieving himself on a minor and then put out an album called Chocolate Factory. This is just not a model of inspiration for me. So, but man, my mom turning that song up super loud and belting it out.
Wow.
Well, it's awful.
Well, here's your film jitsu inspiration. Since everybody wants to play this for the kids to get all excited about someday being Michael Jordan, your kid is statistically 10 times more likely to die from slipping and falling in a tub than becoming a professional athlete.
All right.
So there it is.
Does that mean if you don't own a tub, then your kid definitely becomes a professional athlete?
Pretty sure that's not how statistics work, but sure.
I know very little about statistics. All right, well, that was our number three. I guess then we are on to my number two.
Yep.
It had to be going back to the Kevin Costner well here a little bit. 1991, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Everything I do, I do it for you. Mr. Bryan Adams, the Canadian Wonder Man.
You know it's true, everything I do, oh, I do it for you.
Jesus Christ. The song is sappy and unbelievably annoying. The video had Bryan Adams wearing a denim jacket and playing electric guitar in the middle of Sherwood Forest. Never has there been a better pairing of stupid movie and stupid song than Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and Everything I Do It For You. It was a huge hit. It was on the, I think, the UK number one spot on the billboards for like 16 weeks, which had never been done. It was gigantic at the time.
It set all kinds of records. It set the record in America for being on the number one list at the time.
It set the record for most obnoxious Canadian before my number one, who we will be getting to shortly. But good Lord. Bryan Adams. Actually, I could have just thrown a dart at a long list of Bryan Adams songs and movies, and any one of them could have been on here. But this one is, I don't know, it's just annoying. It's so annoying.
It was so overplayed.
The video with him in Sherwood Forest wearing a denim jacket.
The Canadian tuxedo, as it were.
The Canadian tuxedo, absolutely. Or walking along the shores of England wearing a trench coat. Good Lord. I mean, and, you know, it's not just here because the video was bad. Let me be clear. I understand this is bad songs. Well, this is a song I really cannot take. So it was, you know, it's odd, too. I'm noticing that most of my picks fall right in the... in the 90s. It seems like 91 to, I guess, 2001 was Moulin Rouge, but it seems like that was a period where, I don't know if it's just because I was of an age where I was more aware of movies at that time, or if they were really just that terrible. I don't know, but Everything I do it for you, which, John, might be the theme of Film Jitsu here, because everything that I do, sir, I do for you.
Oh, man, that's a good one. That's a good one. Well, here's another one, and actually, this one could describe my experience with Film Jitsu as well. My number two is I've Had the Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, 1987. Uh-oh. This actually won Best Original Song in 1987. It's that coming-of-age story, Jennifer Grey, Patrick Swayze. People love this movie. This is a darling movie for a lot of people, and... I think part of my problem with it is not only that it's your standard 80s overly romantic gushy bullshit that I can't handle, but at this time, my sister was obsessed with Dirty Dancing. This movie was on in my house at least once a day. And so I've heard this song so many times that I want to actually take a power drill to my temple to dig it out. I can't handle
this. Can I make an embarrassing confession?
Do it.
I think I might kind of like this song. Possible. I mean, I, in my life, have had the time of my life. I hope it's not the only time of my life. But I've had a couple pretty good times of my life. This song fits, I think.
Oh, man.
That was hard for me to do. I can't believe other people are going to listen to this, and I just admitted that I kind of like that song.
Well, I'll go down with you. I'll admit I like this movie, but I can't stand this song.
All right. Well, yeah, I think Dirty Dancing is a good flick. Yeah, a tip of the hat to the late Patrick Swayze as well. The man deserves our respect.
Absolutely. And a tip of the hat to the late Jerry Orbach.
And also, I think, since we're paying respects, we should probably pay our respects to Jennifer Grey's career.
Absolutely.
Because she got plastic surgery on that nose, and she disappeared. She did. That's what happened, is that she got plastic surgery because she felt like her nose was too round, and all of a sudden, she was completely forgettable. That nose really made her kind of stand out, and you went, oh, that's Jennifer Grey. And then she got sort of your normal, average Hollywood beauty nose, and she was completely forgettable and disappeared. All right, well, my number one, I alluded to it before. I don't really think it's a surprise for anyone. It might be your number one, unless you left it off just because you knew I was going to do it, but it's My Heart Will Go On from 1997's Titanic, Celine Dion. Everyone knew it was going to be on the list because it's unbearable. DJs in 1997 put this song on repeat and walked away from their booths for the next 9 months. It didn't matter if you were listening to a pirate radio station featuring the merengue tunes of the 1930s that was being broadcast directly out of Fidel Castro's colon. You heard My Heart Will Go On 45 times a day. This song was so bad that I think it made me start my period.
That I can't. Yep, I can't handle Celine Dion. Anything the woman does, she's unbearable.
Mm-hmm. It's the Canadians, I think. I hope we don't have any Canadian listeners, because if we do, I apologize. But hockey is awesome. Beer is awesome. Montreal is pretty awesome. Celine Dion is not awesome, and neither is Bryan Adams. I apologize.
Yeah. Please keep sending us your comedians and keep your goddamn musical artists.
Yes, that's right. Yep. Your comedians can come our way. Keep your musicians, for the most part, to yourself. We'll take some of them. We will not take Bryan Adams and Celine Dion. Ever, ever, ever.
Nope.
Yeah, I don't know. It was an obvious choice, but I mean, talk about a song that just got overplayed till the point where you couldn't take it anymore. It's not, on its own merits, it's not a terrible song, but it was a song that I think that America was conditioned to hate because of how much it was played, and I don't know. I think Celine Dion has a Vegas show now.
I'm sure.
I will never go to Vegas just because I might hear it walking past a casino. So, oh, that's it for me. My heart will go on. In my case, of course, I wish my heart would stop.
Well, while the opening string notes of that song are like gamma rays that instantly turn me into the Incredible Hulk, my number one is actually your number two. Bryan Adams, Everything I Do it for You.
Really?
Yep. Yep.
Well, good. Now I don't feel like I'm just being a jerk.
No. You're right. The video was awful. The song is horrendous. The movie was bad. I'm actually, strangely enough, looking forward to the Russell Crowe remake.
Of course you are.
Just to get this one out. Just to purge this one. Although, of Men in Tights may have purged this one, so.
That's right. We roam around the forest looking for fights.
Fortunately, this song lost in 1991's Academy Award to Beauty and the Beast.
Zoinks.
But it did win a Grammy, so, you know, proves the Grammys are...
Oh, fair play, I guess. Yeah. Well, good. I feel like we probably... You know what? I suspect we're going to get a lot of feedback from this particular bottom five, because music is something that people take so personally, and of course, it's all just subjective. This is just my list. But I would love to hear back from people on why they think maybe some of the songs we put on there really didn't deserve to be there, or what songs they can't believe that we left off. Yeah. So please. I know our list was very 90s-centric, and I think that's probably a major fault.
Yeah.
So if you have anything, especially from days of yore, then please go ahead and drop us a line at mikeandjohn@filmjitsu.com, because I'd love to hear what else is out there.
And if you can come up with a redeeming quality for Celine Dion, please send that in as well.
Yeah, I'm game. I mean, I'm not closed off to a counter-argument. I just don't know that there is one. All right, John. Well, let's go ahead now and have a word from our sponsor.
Tired of the same old boring nuts? Then you need Mr. Lindsay's Nut Butter. Mr. Lindsay himself has traveled the world searching out a variety of exotic nuts. The Brazil nut, the macadamia, the chestnut, and yes, even these nuts can all be found in Mr. Lindsay's nut butter. We take this special blend of nuts, slow roast them over a period of 4 hours, and then mash them up into a salty, sweet treat that you won't mind getting all over your hands. Mr. Lindsay's nut butter. Spread it between your buns today.
All right. Once again, John, it is that time.
Oh, yeah.
The time in our episode where we play everybody's favorite game, Matinee Deathmatch. This is a segment where I choose a card from a popular party game, and John and I take turns going back and forth with answers that fit the category until one of us blanks and can no longer continue, and then one of us, I'll say it again, probably me, is named the victor. Are you ready, buddy?
Yep, so we keep going until someone's heart can't go on.
That's right, yes, until my heart can't go on. Okay? But you know what? I believe you can play, so go ahead and give it everything you got. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Our category this week is name different movies with Bruce Willis.
The Sixth Sense.
Die Hard.
Unbreakable.
The Whole Nine Yards.
Okay. Damn, that was my next one.
The guy's done a million things.
I know.
Hurry
why
up.
Am I blanking? Why do I keep going to Moonlighting? Live Free or Die Hard.
The aforementioned Armageddon.
Nice. Surrogates.
Jesus Christ. Can't you think of anything that happened more than 5 minutes
no.
ago? You son of a bitch.
I'm blanking.
Pulp Fiction. You're killing me. Keep going.
12 Monkeys.
Four Rooms.
Yeah, I think I'm done. Damn.
Good Lord.
Oh, man. I know I missed a major one or two in there.
You owe a lot of people a lot of apologies.
I do. That was subpar. That was subpar. I'd been doing so well.
I believe that you threw out a sequel to Die Hard, which is some Bush League activity.
That was a time buyer. That's all that was.
All right. Well, that was fun.
I like that one.
It's always fun. I don't know if it's fun for our audience, but it's always fun for us. So
exactly.
We deserve something too, goddammit.
Indeed. And we can always give something fun to our audience by going into staff picks.
Ooh, segue.
Yes. This is where we give you a couple of movies that we're high on right now that you should go and check out. So, Mike, what's big on your list right now?
Well, I decided to go with a movie that I love. I think that if I were to really try and formulate the Mike Merrigan top 10, this would sneak its way in there. Maybe not the best film of all time, but one I certainly love. I'm going with the 1993 Richard Linklater film, Dazed and Confused.
Nice.
It is a movie I adore. I love it. I actually just watched it 2 nights ago with my wife and my mother-in-law. It's a movie that I love to watch this time of year when the weather's getting nice, because it's a movie about the last day of school. It's 1976 in Texas, and it's the last day of school, and there's a tradition in this town where the juniors who are now seniors chase down the incoming freshmen and whack them on their asses. Basically, it's hazing, yes. Is what it is. It's hazing. There's just a big party. The movie is not really about anything. It's just one night of a great big party and all the different personalities that show up. It's a lot of fun. I mean, the soundtrack is great, with Foghat and Alice Cooper, and just about everybody in the film went on to be famous. It has, well, I guess to speak in film jitsu terms, Matthew McConaughey is in it as Wooderson in a very memorable role.
Yeah. My man, what has happened? Long time, no see.
That's right.
What have you been up to?
Same old shit, man.
Yeah?
Working for the city.
Working man, huh?
Been thinking about getting back in school, though, man.
Back in JC, something like that?
Yeah, man. I mean, that's where all the girls are, right?
Stay up.
But on the other hand, man, I just as soon keep working. Keep a little change in my pocket.
Yeah? Wait.
Rather than spend my time listening to some dipshit who doesn't know what the hell he's talking about anyway.
I know what you're talking about.
So you're a freshman, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, man, how's this year's crop of freshman chicks looking?
Wood, you're gonna end up in jail sometime really soon. I know that fact.
No, man. No, I'll tell you. Man. That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
It has Mila Jovovich, Joey Lauren Adams, Ben Affleck, Adam Goldberg's in it. I mean, there are a lot of people in this particular movie, and man, I love it. I love it so much. It's like a party that I get to invite myself to. And at the end of the movie, the party's winding down, and every time I feel a little bit bummed out, like maybe I have to go home now too. So it's a great flick. It's got Parker Posey in it. And you said some bad things about Parker Posey on a previous episode, so I'm not really going to forgive you for that. But man, if you haven't seen Dazed and Confused, please check it out. It is so much fun, especially this time of year. So that was it for me. Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused.
That's a great movie. And I'll tell you, I do. Parker Posey makes me insane, but I think in pretty much every role, that's what she's supposed to be doing. And this is no exception. She's awesome in this.
Yeah, she's the mean girl.
Yeah, and it's perfect for her. She fits it to a T, and I love that performance by her.
And Ben Affleck is great as the jerk. He really is.
There are some solid...
And plus, it's just fun to see Ben Affleck with that ridiculous 70s haircut.
Oh, yeah. They're just solid. It's solid performance after solid performance in that movie. Absolutely. Well, it's funny. I actually went in a similar direction with my pick. I watched this on Saturday. Made myself a nice big breakfast, got a big trough of coffee, and decided I was going to watch this movie on my Netflix instant view there. 1984, Richard Fleischer, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Conan the Destroyer. Not the original.
Yes.
Conan the Barbarian,
no.
Which co-starred James Earl Jones, but the sequel, Conan the Destroyer, Grace Jones, Wilt Chamberlain. This has sword fights, magic, damsel in distress, an evil queen, a demon god. I mean, it's Saturday morning in a movie. It's awesome. I love it.
It's a lot of fun, those goddamn Conan movies. And, you know, this came up before because during our bottom five athlete performances, I believe we got some feedback about Wilt Chamberlain in this movie as Bombada.
Yes.
So that's a good film jitsu tie-in.
Definitely.
Yeah, I like Conan the Destroyer. After the first one, he had proven that, yes, he was in fact barbarous. And he thought, well, I'm not just a barbarian anymore. Now I'm straight up destroying things. Yeah.
Many people criticized this. They said it moved away from the original film, got away from that sort of somber, violent type of tone, including the original story writers. They actually were pretty displeased with this because it became a little bit more fun, a little bit more lighthearted. But I absolutely love this movie. One of my favorite sequences... It's probably one of my favorite battle scenes in any movie. And Conan is being attacked by all these people who are trying to throw nets on him. They're riding around on horses and hitting him. And he actually punches out a horse.
Yes, he does. He horse punches.
And it is the funniest thing I've ever seen. He's like, screw this guy. I'm going to knock your horse out.
Yep. Yeah. That's when you really piss somebody off. When they start punching your horse out, that's when you've made a huge mistake.
I love Grace Jones in this movie. She kills me.
Yeah.
To no end.
That's a lot of fun. I would like to sit down some Saturday and watch Dazed and Confused and then Conan the Destroyer.
That's a double feature meant to happen.
It is. I really think it is. I might make it happen sooner rather than later, I gotta tell you.
Jive talking, you're telling me lies. Jive talking, you wear a disguise. Wow! Jive talking, so misunderstood.
Okay, Mike, why don't we get into a little bit of listener feedback? We've had a few people write in to us this week, so why don't we hear from the people?
I'm going to start us off with an email from Larry Clow. Again, the voice of our advertisements here on Film Jitsu are much beloved advertisements, it turns out.
Indeed.
But Larry writes in with his screen killer feedback. He says... He doesn't have a full bottom five screen killers, but there is a screen killer that's even more terrible and dumber than Jack Frost. The Ginger Dead Man. Yes, that's right. Gary Busey as a killer gingerbread cookie, running around, stabbing people in some sort of industrial bakery. It's a Charles Band joint, which means it's 10 Shades of Terrible. but not so terrible that there wasn't a sequel. It was called The Passion of the Crust.
Oh, no.
Think a killer snowman is dumb? That's some grade A Nobel Prize winning shit when compared to a killer cookie with Gary Busey's face. Truly, truly terrible. I think the fact that he was called the Ginger Dead Man is even worse.
Yeah, those titles, The Passion of the Crust is pretty horrendous.
Yeah, the only funny reason it didn't make my list is probably just because I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I would imagine that somehow Jack Frost would have gotten bumped from number one had I seen Ginger Dead Man. It's funny, a friend of mine, I was out at the movies on Friday with a friend of mine, and he mentioned The Passion of the Crust to me. Huh. So that's pretty funny.
I hope maybe there's a third movie, like a Freddy vs. Jason, where Jack Frost and the Ginger Dead Man square off.
Oh, man.
Like, the Ginger Dead Man would just kind of turn the heat up a little bit in the room, and Jack Frost would just sort of melt, but then the Ginger Dead Man would get all soggy, and that would, I don't know what would happen at the end, but it seems less stupid than the original concepts.
Indeed. Somehow. So I've got one from our friends Chad and Kendra, who write in. Actually, Chad works in the movie industry here in Boston, so we actually do have, I know you made fun of me before for mentioning filmmakers listening, but we actually do have someone involved in the making of films listening to our podcast.
Well, he's not the only one. I'm just saying is that you made it sound as though perhaps there were Hollywood bigwigs with their ear finely tuned to what we had to say, and I don't really think that Hollywood's going to come knocking anytime soon for film jitsu ideas. But yes, we do have some real deal filmmakers that listen, and I appreciate that. So what does Chad have to say?
Chad and Kendra just wanted to say that they fucking scream at me every time I fall short during Matinee Deathmatch. And they follow that up with, "Come on, dude." So definitely people rooting for me, hoping that I can eventually pull off a win in Matinee Deathmatch. And sadly, I disappoint Chad and Kendra. So, actually, Chad has a birthday this week. So, happy birthday, Chad! And
happy
we'll see if I can. We'll see if I can pull off a win in a future episode for Chad.
Oh well. Well, happy birthday, Chad! John failed you again. I have an email here, Mr. Carmichael, from Kristen Dobbs. Kristen writes in to say, "Another great podcast, especially because you answered my question. Last week, Kristen wrote in asking us about legal movies. She is a law student and wanted us to give some of our legal movie wisdom. I think I went with The Verdict, and you went with
Miracle on 34th Street.
Miracle on 34th Street, that's right. Kristen says, "I do find the podcast informative as my DVD shelves are filled with mostly West Wing DVDs and Mean Girls. And don't worry, I'm not becoming an intellectual property lawyer, so my ignorance is not a deal breaker." Anywho, I wanted to comment on John's miserable performance, as usual, on Matinee Deathmatch. Come on, John, teen movies. I would figure that would be right in your wheelhouse. I think in punishment, you would have to watch the ultimate bad teen movie of my high school days, She's All That. Or, in the alternative, Drive Me Crazy. Or really any movie starring Julia Stiles or Freddie Prinze Jr. will do. That comes in from Kristen. You know, it seems like Team John is really pulling for you. You seem to be the underdog, and everybody loves an underdog.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Kristen gets bonus points for having a shelf full of West Wing DVDs, and negative points for having seen She's All That.
That's true. Yeah, I think West Wing is a... Although we are a film podcast, I would argue that that was probably just as good on a weekly basis as any other drama that I've seen on film, so I think it's a film jitsu favorite.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know about Mean Girls and She's All That. Well, good. It's always nice hearing back from the fans, John.
Indeed. I enjoy that. Keep those emails coming in. Again, that email address is mikeandjohn@filmjitsu.com.
Happy 10th episode, by the way.
Absolutely.
Sir.
I totally forgot to mention that in the opening. Happy 10th episode.
The big double digits.
Nice. We made it.
All right. Well, good. We're halfway to 20. If we make it that far, it'll be a miracle. Well, I guess then, John, we are at the time in our show where I reveal to you what movie you're going to be watching for our next episode, number 11.
Scares me.
I thought, well, geez, it's episode 11. I really have to turn it up to 11 here this time. John, before I reveal the title to you, we need to have a conversation. The conversation is about whether or not I can trust your word.
Oh.
If I ask you to do something, will you do it?
Yes.
Wow, that was really
easy. I take this podcast very seriously.
Okay. I'm going to ask that when I give you the title, you get the movie, you watch the movie, but I don't want you to do any research about it beforehand. Okay. I don't want you to know a single thing that happens in this movie until you see it on screen. Can I have your word that you will go dark on this title and just do nothing but watch it?
That's going to be tough, but I will commit to that. For Film Jitsu, for our listeners, who I love and adore, I will do that.
I need your word.
You have my word.
Okay. For next week's episode, you will be watching one of the most infamous films of all time. I speak, of course, the 1972 John Waters film, Pink Flamingos.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
Uh-huh. Awesome.
Sweet. Oh, sweet Jesus.
I went there.
Wow.
Pink Flamingos. This is... I believe the tagline to the movie is an exercise in poor taste. It is an understatement like you would not believe.
Oh, wow.
It's a movie about the filthiest people alive. That's true. And I'm actually going to back it up and say that, in fact, these are the filthiest people alive. So I know that you're going to be tempted because this is an infamous movie. And you're going to want to find out all the things that are in it that make it so infamous. Don't do it.
I don't know a lot about this movie. I've heard of it. And I know who one of the big characters that is, I guess, big, has multiple meanings there.
You speak, of course, of Divine.
Indeed. And I've been told that something rather horrific happens at the very end, and that's all I know about it. So,
have you been told what happens at the very end?
I've had people sort of explain... I don't know if I know exactly what happens, but I have a hint of what potentially happens at the very end.
Well, let's leave it at that. Because I want your word that you will not look up a single detail about this movie and that you will watch it from start to credits.
Absolutely.
All right. This is so unfair of me after having just had to watch The Bodyguard, which I kind of didn't hate, and then I go ahead and hit you with Pink Flamingos. But I thought, man, for episode 11, I had to turn it up to 11. You're going to have a hard time getting back at me for this.
Oh, man.
I really look forward to what you have to say about Pink Flamingos, and I think our audience is really going to enjoy our upcoming episode. So,
if I puke during this movie, I'm face-punching you.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. You're a man who has always said that, you know, you don't really have any taboos, and you've seen everything, and you're that. So we're going to put it to the test, buddy.
All right. Well...
Pink Flamingos next week.
Indeed.
Be there.
Indeed. Well, that concludes another episode of Film Jitsu, episode 10. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and join us next week when I will be apparently remarkably grossed out, probably needing to shower several times after watching Pink Flamingos. So, again, thanks for listening. We're your host. I'm John.
And I am Mike.
See you next time.
Сімнате, хочу зацікати, в'єжба чусати і сати, карате, карате, я хочу так задній вікяй, застане і задже, карате,
карате, and a tip of the hat to the late Patrick Stewart. Jesus Christ. Let's try that again.
No one puts baby in the corner.
That movie would have been so different if Patrick Stewart had been Patrick Swayze instead.